So karma. So people think it's a lot. I hear. It is a lot. Karma is a complex thing. Maybe that's why it doesn't get taught so much. And, you know, the risk is to oversimplify. And then when we, in the West, if you oversimplify, then that just gives, you know, people doubts because they can't go along with the oversimplification. But then when you try to get into the real complexity of it, then that's intense. And you know, because for the arising of any result, you have the cause, a cause, you have a karmic cause, and then you have this array of conditions. So you have causes and conditions. So you have a karmic cause that ripens in a result. In order to do that, all the conditions have to come together for that cause to ripen. Those conditions are incredibly numerous. And if you can go back in time and contemplate the causes for a particular result. If you go back a little bit in time, the causes become astronomical. You know, if you think of the causes for this retreat, for instance. Okay, so we each have our karmic cause for being here. Yeah. And there's a group karma, just to add another factor. You can have a group karma. A group can have karma because of the creation of past actions together. So you can create a karma together as a group. So because we're all here today in this highly auspicious place in a highly auspicious activity, then a Buddhist with a lot of confidence in karma knows that in the past, in some past life, or more recently, maybe even in this life, for some of us, but at least in some past life, we all have done some positive actions together and created the karma to do this together. Now, I know that takes a lot of Buddhist worldview to get on board for that, but it's interesting. At the very least, it's useful and interesting to know that the karma you create together, the things that you do together with other people, create karma as a group. So, for instance, as Americans, for instance, we create group karma, which is a scary thought. Yeah? So, if you know, if one passively goes along with it, you have to have the intention. You have to participate with, but not very, doesn't take too much. You can just passively go along with something. Yeah? And you acquire the karma of that action. So, it behooves us to be aware of the things that we kind of passively go along with. Yeah, because we create karma together as a group. So that's one interesting thing about the complexity of karma. So then if we think again about the causes for this retreat, then so we have each of us have our karmic cause. We have this group karma. And then there are the conditions. And if we look at all the conditions that had to come together for us to get here, to do this, just start thinking of the people that are involved that aren't here that helped create this. And all the people that helped them do the jobs or make the people that made this place, for instance. You know, all the people that built it. All the people who have maintained it as a shared space. All the people who have cultivated it as a practice, as a venue for practice. Obviously, Mountain Hermitage. What an incredible whole bunch of people there creating the conditions for us to do this. And then, so, you know, just looking at that, you've got thousands and thousands and thousands of causes if you were to contemplate it. And then for each of us to be here, we had to all be here. We had to be able to get here. You know, you know, our bosses were part of the causes. You know, the people that transported us here, that flew the planes, that took the, to drove us in the taxis, that are watching our dear little cats. Seriously, you are my housemate, my new housemate. You know, our new housemate. You know, she's part of the conditions for why we're all sitting here. You don't even know her, but she's a major condition for, you know, this happening. And then, of course, you can go back to, you know, the parents of the people. Your parents. You're all your parents. Your grandparents. The people who made it possible for you to get an education. To learn to read, for instance. All of your teachers. So, you know, you can see this is a very vast contemplation. So for any particular action, there's a lot of conditions that have to come together for it to ripen. You know, the computer was originally developed by the military because they wanted to, some of you have heard me tell this story before, but I tell it again anyway. They wanted to predict weather accurately, because the country that can predict the weather could win the battle. Yeah, so that's how the computer got its initial, you know, funding. You can imagine, you know, the powers that be funding this research. But of course, the problem was, for any given weather occurrence, the conditions were so numerous, almost infinite, that they could never really, the computer never was able to, and still is not able to, accurately predict the weather, because you have to program almost everything in it to get the result. So this is, you know, this is the origin of the chaos theory, where we say if a butterfly dies in the South Pacific, it's a condition for a hurricane in the in Asia. Yeah, so it's not surprising that you feel it's complex. It is. And this is why, I mean, the arising of a particular ripening, we're not going to know all of the conditions, yeah. And the cause, in the Buddhist worldview, maybe the cause, you know, your own part of it, your own cause, your own the karmic intention that is ripening. Maybe it's something recent. Maybe it is something you can remember. Oh yeah, I see. I had a hand in this. There's something that. There's some receptivity in me that is interpreting this in this way and is ready to suffer from it. You can't make a person suffer. You can cause a person pain, but you cannot make a person suffer. We do that all ourselves, and that is the basic operational principle of Dharma. So for any particular cause, maybe the cause is really old. Maybe it's like lifetimes back there in the Buddhist worldview. Maybe it's lost to our awareness. And they like to say, you know, we've been everything. If you think, okay, if the continuity of the mind is beginningless, and we've had infinite numbers of lives, they like to say we've been everything and we've done everything. So we got all kinds of karmic causes here just waiting for the conditions to come together for both kusala causes and akusala causes. So we'll address that again in a minute when we talk about the operation, the four principles of operation of karma. But this is why, this is one of the most important reasons that a Buddha, or that a Bodhisattva, somebody with a sincere, strong, passionate wish to be able to benefit others, this is one of the most important reasons that they aspire to remove all of the obstacles to wisdom, so that they aspire to omniscience. The reason being that it takes omniscience to understand all of the conditions and all the causes, the long continuity of causes for a particular person, their karmic, a person's karmic constitution. And because we are owners of our own karma, even a Buddha can only help in accord with our own karma. So a Buddha can't help us. Buddha can't do a darn thing for us unless we have the karma to be receptive and open to that benefit. So, you know, the Buddha, Venerable Dhammadina, this was actually in Albuquerque, was talking about this net of compassion that the Buddha would cast to see who is, wasn't that Albuquerque? Well, okay, good. It was a whole 2 days ago. I can't remember what we taught where. The Buddha cast this net of compassion to see who's got some karmic ripening, who's got some karma that he can interact with and benefit, that he could be a condition for. So the Buddha, too, is just a condition. Yeah, he's not the cause. The karmic causes are our own. A Buddha is a condition for the ripening of our potential. Yeah. So then a Buddha wants to know what our karmic possibilities are, because then he could be very skillful. You know, he could know how best to help. You know, if in your profession, if you're a mental health worker, if you're a healer, if you're a nurse, if you're somebody who tries to help, almost everything that we do actually tries to help, actually. If you've got kids, heaven forbid, if you've got kids that you would like to help, you know how difficult it is to help another being skillfully. How difficult it is to say the right thing at the right time, do the right thing at the right time. You have to know their disposition. You have to know their karmic makeup. So that's why a Buddha wants omniscience. Otherwise, you don't really need omniscience. You don't so much need to know. The realization of emptiness will do you just fine. But if you want to help beings, then you need something more than that. Yeah. So where was I now? So yes, karma. So everything we're experiencing right now is the ripening of a past karma. And you all know, sitting right here, right now, there's 14, 15, 16 people here in this room. There are 16 different experiences right now, aren't there? There aren't any two of us hearing the same thing, thinking the same thing, feeling the same thing. We're having 16 different experiences, aren't we? And those are all karmic, personal karmic ripenings. Even though the conditions are all the same, even though the external stuff is all the same, still, we're all experiencing something a little different, aren't we? And probably in a spectrum quite different. You know, maybe your back hurts and you're exhausted from the day and you're really wishing, okay, I've only got 45 more minutes. I'll make it. I know I'll make it. And you're just struggling. Maybe you hurt. Maybe your knee hurts and you're distracted and you've really done as much thinking, meditating, and hearing as you could do in one day. But you're here. But you're here, you see. So that you've got this ripening. So everybody's got their ripening. Maybe some of them are a little bit suffering, ripening. Yeah? A little bit painful, ripening. But, okay, then, so there's the ripening, the experience, but then there's how you respond to that experience. So your experience is a result based on past karma, and that's past familiarization. But mostly, this is like a lot of habit. It's like a lot of repetitious familiarization with certain kinds of mental states, yeah, so that they tend to arise given certain conditions, yeah. So we've all got different ripenings, different results right now. But then there is, how do you respond to that result? How do you respond then to this experience you're having right now? So there's the how do you respond to the pain in the knee or the distracted mind, yeah? Or the only 45 more minutes, yeah? That's a ripening. There's not a lot you can do about that. Now, Venerable Domodina likes to sometimes catch me on that point. And she likes to say, well, a really good meditator can catch that and, you know, change it before it even, you know, through awareness, grab it before it actually arises and ripens. I think that's pretty darn hard to do. But you guys get good at it, and then you tell me if you can catch that, that initial little... ripening. It's a ripening based on past causes, and unless you're a darn good mindful meditator with spot on attention, you know, it's going to ripen, and there's virtually nothing you can do about it. With some exceptions. You can purify it, and we'll talk about that later. Yeah. So there's a thing that you can do about karma without just letting it ripen too. There's also a thing we can do about that, but that's later in the week. Yes, that's right. That's right. There is a thing you can do, and it's really powerful. It's a really powerful thing you can do with past karmas. And as practitioners, you know, that's what we say we do. We do part of our practice is purification, cleaning up old habits and karma. And part of our practice is cultivating new, skillful mental states and new habits. We, in the Mahayana tradition anyway, we call that merit. Basically, it's positive karma. Why don't we say positive karma in the Mahayana tradition? I don't know. It took me the longest time to decide. Now, is positive karma exactly the same thing as merit? And yes, it is. So there you go. Now you don't have to think about that for years. So, where was I? I distracted myself there. That's right. Okay, so it's arising. Not a lot we can do about that. Arising, yeah. So anger, the same way. So somebody, we're at a stop sign, somebody tailgating, they've been tailgating us for 5 minutes, we've been looking in the mirror, we stop the stop sign rather suddenly, bang, we get rear-ended instantly. We have the arising of that moment of anger, but due to past familiarization, due to karma, we have that that propensity, that karmic seed for the anger to arise. But now, okay, so that's the result. That's not actually the karma that we're creating yet, because now there's a, how do we respond to this experience? Yeah?
So yeah. Just, so okay, because you have the arising of anger, and that is a karma ripening. Mm-hmm. But that itself is not creating another karma. It depends on what you do next.
What you do next, because there has to be an intention.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The arising of that first moment, it's a habit almost. It's a karmic seed that as soon as the conditions come together, it is going to ripen. Yeah. But we do have our moment of freedom, our moment of progress, our moment of change is how to respond. Do we buy into and run with that negative emotion, or do we do something different? If we do something different, it's very strong karma, very strong kusala action, especially if it's in the face of a rising akusala kind of mental state, because it takes a lot of dharma, hearing, thinking, and meditating to have enough wisdom and mindfulness to think, wait a minute, I don't want to fan these flames. This is not somewhere. This is not a healthy place. This is not a kusa place I want to go. I don't want to go to this place. And still we might have. We've got the adrenaline in our body because somebody's just tailgated, just hit us, right? So we still have the adrenaline in the body, and we still feel irritated, and maybe we're even still pretty darn mad, but we are not. We have a doubt about it. We've put a foot in the door, and we're not totally buying into it.
Is that piece of volition?
Yes, there's a lot of volition in that. There's a lot of intention in that, and it's very kusala, because it's full of that wisdom that understands what is a healthy, clear mind of well-being. What is a mind that is conducive of well-being, clarity, wisdom, and health. So there's a lot of wisdom that's already trained to know this is not a place that I don't want to encourage it. So maybe it's still going on, fluttering along, because we're new practitioners, right? New as in, you know, even 20-year practitioners. Yeah. it's those emotions, once they've got their, you know, momentum going, just to put the foot in the door and to say, I'm not buying into it. It's not me. Yes, that emotion is cooking along. It's simmering along there. But it's not me. It's a karmic ripening. Which is different than an untrained person who is mad and gets madder. Or maybe even believes in the virtue of the anger. I mean, a lot of people will tell you the anger is virtuous and righteous. You know how I need my anger in order to be empowered, in order to make a good change. We could get into a total sidetrack on that, which I won't do. But just to say that anger never helped anybody make change, because it takes a lot of skill to make change. If you want to effectively change the world, you need to have a lot of patience and a lot of skill. Okay, anyway, so so for instance then, when Venerable was talking this morning about our dear roommate Jen, so she's hearing the story, the cat gets the claws stuck in the sweater, and her response to that is, or even the cat hisses, let's make it more active. It's not just because I've seen her, she's standing in the kitchen, and my poor housemate who loves the cat and is so compassionate and patient extending with the cat, still the crabby cat hisses at her when she tries to pet her. Anyway, so she knows, well, she, what was that?
Old crabby
cats. That's right. She thinks, she doesn't take it personally that the cat hisses at her, you see. She says, oh, the cat is, look, it's limping, doesn't want to be touched, it probably doesn't feel so well. So this arises for her based on past causes. So that's a positive karmic ripening. She's familiarized with that kind of compassion, and it arises then as her result. And then she, when that feeling, that thought arises, she consents to it. She recognizes this is positive, and she commits to it. So she further strengthens. Now she's creating a karmic cause, and then she verbalizes it, and says, "Oh, the cat has probably got an achy hip." So that makes that karma even stronger, because it's completely, and we're going to talk about this later, it's completely, it's been externalized into the world, even verbally. Yeah, same thing happens with, we could do the same thing with anger. Yeah, the anger arises, okay, that's based on past karmic causes. We're all practitioners. It's okay, we know that these are all their mental states we're working with in our practice. Yeah, part of our practice is the kind of and part of what we accomplish in our sitting practice is a kind of radical self transparency, honesty that we can we feel confident that we can acknowledge our negative emotions when they arise, and we feel confident because we feel like we've got some tools in our toolbox that we're able to work with those. So it's not like hopeless. We don't have to pretend that we're not angry. So we recognize it, and but it's how we respond to it, and do we buy into it, or do we think to ourselves, that's not such a great reaction. I'm mad and I don't believe in it. and then we don't verbalize it. Yeah. Because there's enough space there. We've created a little space with our wisdom. There's a little space between the, you know, have emotion, open mouth, stick foot in it, which is the usual simultaneous process. As Dharma practitioners, we're slowing that down and creating a little space so that we have emotion, we have a little insight into it, and then we do not open the mouth and stick foot in it. Yeah? Anyway, let's see. So, of course, this is a lot of, as I said yesterday, there's a lot of responsibility in this view. But at the same time, there's incredible freedom. You know, we give up blame. We also give up being the victim. Yeah. Which doesn't mean we can't work with the conditions. It doesn't mean we can see conditions that need resolving or eradicating. We could still work with the conditions. But there's a qualitative difference in feeling I'm going to work with the conditions there's a qualitative difference between that and it's all their fault and I'm the victim. Yeah, there's a big difference between those two, and the difference is about one's own personal suffering. Because in truth and in fact, the blame and the feeling of being victimized doesn't actually make us more effective in the world and doesn't help us work with the conditions. So, yeah. Okay, so, and let me just say that I know I'm going fast through this stuff, and we're going to add a Q&A session tomorrow afternoon, so and it'll be optional. So
I was thinking that we'll do it during the lecture times, hopefully starting in the morning. It depends on how much you cover now.
During the lecture times? Oh, I thought we were going to have a separate Q&A.
Because I just finished the interview, so I realized there's people have a lot of questions. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I don't know. Okay. Okay. Then scratch that. I know I'm going fast, and it's too bad. Q&A will happen tomorrow. I don't know when. So I want to review the qualities of Kusala. I kind of have already, but let's go back. Let's go on to the four principles for the operation of karma. And I think you might even have that on your sheet. What is it called? It's called general operations. Or also called four principles of karma. You know, all these numbers, the four this, the six that, the three this, the eight that. It's the Indians. It's a good pedagogical technique, though. It does help us learn. But we do have to understand that that's, you know, quite a bit of conceptuality with this numbered list thing. Once I heard somebody ask a Tibetan Lama, like, what's up with all the numbers? That doesn't seem very related to, like, the ultimate nature of reality. And he goes, oh, numbers. They're for people that like numbers. Just skillful means for the disposition of those who like lists and numbers. But I have noticed that, you know, people will, you know, they won't be taking a note, but then when you say, oh, the four conditions for karma, everybody grabs their pen and wants to write down all four. And if you miss one, they will raise their hand and tell you, what was the fourth one? Ask you. On the other hand, if you just, you know, discuss the four conditions and you don't give them their numbers.
We've all been conditioned by our educational
system.
Yes, that's right.
It doesn't matter that you're not testing us, it's conditioned.
So. It's conditioned, uh-huh, interesting. Yeah, that probably is so true. Yes, anyway. So, the four principles. The first, we've been talking about quite a bit already. And that is that the short version is that karma is definite, which means that kusala actions have the result of what we can describe conventionally as happiness. They are definite to ripen as happiness. And akusala causes are definite to ripen as what we would describe as unhappiness or even suffering. And we do have to, of course, distinguish pleasure and happiness. And we've, you know, in our discussion of what is kusala, we've been talking a little bit about the nature of happiness, which isn't necessarily identical with pleasure. And of course, in the kind of the non-dharma commodities world, pleasure is, capitalist world, if I might even say, pleasure is virtually equated with happiness. So, you know, you get nice things, you have nice sense experiences, you have pleasure, momentary pleasure, it doesn't matter if it's momentary, it's happiness. And that's where we're kind of indoctrinated and taught that that's happiness and that's what we should go for. That's the great thing about life, is to get as much pleasure as you can, and that will make you happy. Of course, that's why we're all Dharma practitioners, because somewhere along the line we realized that all that pleasure was not indeed leading us to happiness, but perhaps just exactly the opposite. So that's the first general principle, that the results are in line with their causes. You know, and I use that analogy. You plant a pumpkin seed, you get a pumpkin. You plant a pumpkin seed, you do not get a tomato. Yeah. The second principle is that, and this is very interesting and adds yet another level of complexity, which is that karmic imprints tend to increase. Meaning that the result is often, or at least sometimes, greater than the cause. And this, of course, is true for not only akusala actions, but kusala actions, which is the reason why a very small act of kindness can ripen into a very great experience of happiness. Unfortunately, conversely, very small negative actions, akusala actions, can ripen into quite a bit of suffering. So, aside from the obvious then kind of caution to watch, to be careful about even small actions, I think even more important ramification of this is the value of small positive actions. And especially, I think, you know, we have very high standards for good actions. And I think, and Venerable Dhammadina also was kind of referring to this obliquely yesterday also, in terms of the importance of recognizing and noticing our own positive qualities and positive actions. Because in the being aware of the our positive actions and qualities, that awareness is a potent force for the increase of those actions. It's part of the feedback loop. Because if we're mindful and aware of our own positive actions, we'll see the correlations and the connections between those actions and the contentment and happiness that they result in. So we'll see we're more likely to see their results, you see. Which means if we see our results, that's the education loop, that's the feedback loop that gives us confidence and encourages us. It trains us, basically. Life will train us if we live long enough. Life will train us to engage in kusala actions, If we're sensitive, we pay attention, we see the results, life will train us to engage in those kinds of, to cultivate those kinds of mental states, those kinds of intentions, yeah, and those kinds of actions as they manifest in our body and actions of body and speech. Life will train us to increase those by regularly showing us the reward of happiness for those kinds of actions. Likewise, life will train us to decrease the negative actions for the simple reason that we'll see eventually, if we're reflective and we're paying attention, that they cause us hurt and suffering. So that awareness of, so we can go faster. We can go faster in our development by appreciating and being mindful of our own positive actions, which means all the little small positive kusala, all the small kusala thoughts, the generous thought, the kind thought, the wish of the goodwill, the flowery, a moment of goodwill towards another, compassion, a moment of compassion. Not necessarily, we can't necessarily act on all of those. But if we become aware of the power of those, and we see that small moments can increase, we'll value those more. And we won't sit around waiting for like great actions of like saving the world to feel like we're doing valuable positive things in our lives. Yeah? It's hard to save the world. It takes a lot of karma to be in a position to save the world. You need a lot of karma, and a lot of conditions have to come together to make some big splash positive action. I mean, we probably all wish we could do some great noble positive action, but few of us will get the chance to do that because of the conditions that we have to have the resources for it. The opportunity. You have to say the right thing and do the right thing at the right moment. And even then, the thing is, you do your positive action in the world, and if it does not fall on the right conditions, it does not necessarily out there in the world result in. When we talk about the result, this is a result that you yourself get from that. That compassion. Yeah? So we can't necessarily look to the outside world to ratify and appreciate our positive actions. Yeah? Because they won't necessarily, the world needs the conditions will have to be there, the karma will have to be there for the benefit to ripen in the world. Yeah. Once we put that action out there into the world, all the conditions with all the moving parts in the world, human beings taking that positive action up. Human beings are good at, they can take a positive action and turn it into something quite negative, in fact, unfortunately. Which isn't to say now, I'm not meaning to say that we shouldn't try. We want to try, and of course we have that intention, you see. So when the opportunity arises, of course, we want to enact that intention. It's just that we don't want to value that only on the basis of its actual result in the world. The value is in giving rise to that mind, giving rise to that kusala mind. And then we have to understand then, if we understand that kusala mind then increases And by repetitious familiarity, with those kusalam intentions, they increase, which of course increases our ability and the likelihood to be able to say and do the right thing at the right moment in the world. Yeah? So, yeah, the small actions, the small gestures in the world, the small, the moments of kindness, goodwill, patience, do not undervalue those. And it is part of your practice to note them. It is important, irreplaceable in the path, that you rejoice in your own positive thoughts, intentions, actions. So that's the second. Karmic imprints increase. The third is that we won't experience a result that we didn't create the causes for. This simply means that we are owners of our own karma, and that nothing we experience arises without a cause. Yeah.
So, like in the example you gave of when anger arises, that's a ripening of past karma.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't then act on that anger.
Yeah, then you're creating a new
karma.
Well, you're creating a new positive karma.
By not.
Yeah, the refraining.
Even though you felt anger, it had it arise. That's old one.
That's an old one.
Okay.
It's ripened. It's done.
Well,
yeah.
That.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's an important thing.
You know, a feeling would be like, oh, I got angry. I felt anger. Therefore, I've now made a new karma of anger.
No. In fact, that refraining, that's a very powerful, that's an incredibly powerful intention. It's a very powerful karma because it means that you had the mindfulness to be aware of it. You had the wisdom to know that this is not where you want to go. Yeah. And then you had the skill to not buy into it. Yeah. And then you refrain in so many moments here. And then hopefully you refrain from, yeah, telling the guy what you think of him when you jump out of your car. Yeah. So, and that's a power, that refraining. See, to catch those moments, to catch them with your mindfulness and your awareness, and to refrain from buying into them, from fanning the flames.
Now, so yeah, you could start to, if you have past karma for getting angry, then each time you're able to do that, then you're retraining your mind, really.
That's exactly
and
right.
And you'll have less moments of
that's exactly
angry.
Right. That's exactly
the feedback loop.
It's the feedback. That's exactly
that's
right.
Awesome.
You're creating a new habit, and that kind of awareness in the face of a strong emotion, it's very powerful. Getting your foot in the door the first few times, that's probably the hardest, the most difficult, but even just a couple of times getting your foot in the door, the feeling of satisfaction of not the refraining and the non-escalating of the situation, the non-creating of additional problems in your immediate personal environment. The success is a very encouraging thing that will make it easier then the next time. You'll quickly get in the habit of not buying into. And of course, we're using anger as an example here, but any of the mental states, just to distance And in very strong mental states, you know, you may only be able to get as much as, oh, I see this is anxiety, and I see it's a ripening of karma, and I'm not going to buy into it, but you may still be experiencing that anxiety. Yeah, that's right. And so much familiarity with it. And even to the point of like a biological familiarity, you know, like you've cooked your nervous system to be very responsive. So it might be quite a while and take quite a lot of repetition to begin to tone down that emotional response. But just to get enough, just to get the foot in the door to know this is the arising of karma, and it's not me, it's a karmic result, and I don't have to buy into it or intentionally just succumb to it. Like I don't need to fan, as I say, fan the flames, like get in there and just encourage it. I'm not going to encourage it. That's a success right there. I'm not going to encourage it. It's there. It's my habit. But I don't have to. It's not me. I don't have to encourage it. It's an unpleasant feeling. It's unpleasant. But maybe I don't need to suffer from it so much.
This is just great, because I really had the thought that each time you fall down on, you know,
That's right. If you couldn't do something, if there wasn't a moment of change, it would be hopeless, wouldn't it? Because all the mind moments, like when you realize that they're all karmic, you're creating karma with all of these mental moments. It is a little, but see, that's these great emotions. Then it becomes your, you know, great opportunity. You know, and then it'll start to feel like that. You know, you'll start to feel some skill in the rising of the emotion and some mastery of your responsiveness to it, and the fact that you don't have to be completely like knocked off your feet, totally identified with it, and knocked off your feet completely by it, and then it's just like, you know, driving a really sporty car, you know, or I don't know, skiing around obstacles. It is, and it's just in the same way if you were trying to learn a sport that was required a lot of skill, like I don't know what would be one. Any of them, yeah. This is tennis, okay? I can't play tennis at all, but tennis. So if I were to go out, pick up a tennis racket, and try to learn tennis, it would take me months, if not years, of repetition to develop, to, you know, change my body and responsive responses and make some of those things, like, not, to make them very, like, subliminal and, it would take a heck of a lot of repetition, yeah, to become skillful. In the same way, it's going to require a lot of repetition for us also to, you know, change those biochemical responses that we're so used to just completely giving into. But, you know, even now, some of the, we've got one of our students last year was a... neurobiologist, were you there? Yeah, we were discussing that. You were there in class. We were discussing this very topic with her and in class. And you know, now, like, science is beginning to catch up with Buddhism. And there, you know, with in terms of neuroplasticity, and even more profound than the neuroplasticity, that you really can change the pathways of the brain now with practice. It is not a quick fix, but it can slowly over time. not only do we have the plasticity of the brain, but now they are saying that actual thought habits are likely to be even affecting the DNA. Yeah. So thought habits and behaviors actually can even affect the DNA. So we can actually pass, apparently, this is like the cutting edge thing, right? We can even pass on to future generations our own thought and action habits. That's pretty profound. So yes, it does. It's really, and it makes you more interested. It makes you very interested in your ancestry, and grateful or not. You know, I'm really Celtic Irish through and through, and I have some inherited pathways that, my father, for instance, I'm sure if anything could be changed by behavior, he did it, I'm sure. But also it makes you, there's also a sense of gratitude, too, because regardless of what disadvantages we may have received from our immediate and older ancestors. Now you've got me onto a topic that is very dear to my heart. It's quite amazing that we owe a lot to our ancestors. It's incredible that we survive. It's incredible that we're here. So much sacrifice many different individuals and generations in our past have in their lives done so that their children's children's children would live and be well. And that's kind of an amazing thing. And you can go way, 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 way back and think, pretty amazing sacrifices were made by people that are in our past. It's nice to have, like, one of the, when we talk about generating bodhicitta, this wish to become enlightened to benefit, this Mahayana wish to benefit beings, you know, there's the meditation on the kindness of others, and so this contemplation on all of the conditions and all of the people who have made it possible for us to be here, to live, and to do something like practice the Dharma. It's an incredible contemplation that fills the heart with gratitude and a sense of being surrounded by the kindness of others. Well, that's a different kind of contemplation than looking around and thinking of all the problems that, you know, others, all the lacks. That's my watch going off here, I think. I don't know why it is, but I can't set the darn thing. it'll be quiet soon. yes. Anyway, so let's move on here before I go too far on that topic. So then the last principle of karma is that karmic causes are never lost. Eventually, they're there. Karma, once you've put the energy, once you've created the energy, it will ripen, whether positive or negative. It's just a matter of the conditions coming together. Unless there's some kind of impediment to the karma by way of purification. So one can purify through skillful psychological means. One can purify negative karma. One can also cut negative karma at the root with one's realization of emptiness, which is, we don't have to, the other methods for purifying are more immediately accessible. And very psychologically brilliant and healthy, and we'll talk about those later. And then also it's said that we can also wreck our positive karma too. They say that, anger can destroy positive karma. And we kind of know that a moment of anger can destroy a lot of positive karma. And we know that, in our relationships with others, for instance, that we can have a really great connection with somebody and, we can have years of positive karma with that positive interactions with that person, and one moment of anger can just wipe it all out. So the working with anger, then, of course, the anger is the really dangerous one. They say anger is the first one we want to get under control because it does the most damage, and then of course, it's the easier one to get control of, because when we start looking at attachment craving, that requires even greater wisdom, because we all know that anger is, everybody sitting here has a real confident feeling that anger is not our friend. Yeah, it hurts us physically, it hurts us socially, it hurts us in many different ways. But the craving attachment thing, when attachment and craving arises, we can't resist having the little thought, ooh, that's my friend pointing me in the direction of something nice to experience. So it takes a lot more reflection to see the suffering that follows in the wake of obsessive craving. So let's see, what else might I want to say here? Questions? Maybe a question or two.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So when you were talking about actions that are not done do not yield results.
Yeah.
I think there was an evening before there was mention of thoughts can have negative karma.
Yeah. A thought, like for instance, so like our thought or our mental state, our mind condition, yes, those can be kusala, healthy, or they can be akusala. Yeah? So, and every thought is... because it has some intention, it's going somewhere. Just the intention that points one to look in a particular direction. One wants to see that. There's an intention. Yeah. Now, if I want to look at that cushion, maybe that's a fairly neutral intention. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have much, doesn't have much kick to it, any karmic kick. But on the other hand, if I look at the spread of food on the table, the lunch all spread out there, my eyes, my intention, my awareness is directed to something that looks interesting, wanting, yeah? I'm attracted to that, yeah? So even just the turning the mind towards something has an intention. So our thoughts, what we're thinking about, there's an intentionality there where we're directing the mind. And so then all of those thoughts have their karmic, all of those thoughts or mental states, all of those mental states have their will have their karmic ripening.
So, with the anger example, you're stopping the anger response. So, if you have a negative thought about a different political group or something, then how do you talk about the stopping
Oh, with the thought. Okay, so the thought comes to my mind. I feel like I should turn off the recorder. I hope this politician loses big time. We're about to do something maybe really startling in Seattle. I don't know, I shouldn't talk about politics. I get in trouble every time I do, but we might elect a socialist. We might elect a socialist onto our city council in Seattle, Washington. And it's against an incumbent that's, you know, very popular, well-known for many sessions. Anyway, so I have the thought, may he lose like crazy. And maybe there's even a little ill will there. As soon as I recognize that, okay, so that arises, yeah. And I recognize it, and instead of like dwelling on, well, you know, I can run with that. I can think, whoa, I can imagine him, you know, having to get on TV and give his farewell speech. And you know, I can imagine, you know, I can really run with how he might, you know, how he deserves.
Shame and humiliation.
Shame and humiliation. I could go with that, and I could wish, you know, you know, not nice things for him, and I could just indulge that and go for it. But then I could think, well, or I could think, well, that man has given a lot during the last 16 years, and could I do a better job than he's done? I don't know that I could. And he probably wakes up every morning wanting to be a hero and do a great job, and he's probably done many good things in the process of probably making some mistakes too, and you know, he's not an inherently there's nothing inherently bad or wrong about him, and for all I know, maybe he's actually done a better job than some, even my socialist hero might do in the future. I don't know. Well, I don't really know. I'm projecting. It's all conceptual. It's conceptual. I think that so instead of feeding the flames, yeah, I'm going to inject wisdom into my thought process. So instead of cultivating, you know, spite and glee and ill will at someone, instead of running with that, instead I'm going to turn the mind to something more realistic. And it is more realistic, yeah, and kinder and compassionate. Yeah. So our thoughts, you know, you can run in the same way. You know, there's some obsessive thing you want, and you know, you could go on a big fantasy craving spree and just indulge that. How nice it would be if I get that. No, how can I get it? And when can I get it? And it would be like this, and it would be like that. And oh, it would be so wonderful, and then I would be happy. What's that? And none of it's true. That's right. So you can indulge that and up the ante, or you can inject some wisdom into the thought. You inject the wisdom into that thought, that experience, and once again, then you've got a big, powerful kusala karma in the face of what you might habitually have done without a dharma practice. And then, so then you're creating the mind. You're creating the, you know, do you want a consciousness that, like, wishes ill will, that glories in someone's suffering, that sees the worst in someone? Or do you want to cultivate a consciousness? Is this the kind of mind you want to have in the future? A mind that's compassionate, sees a whole round, many sides to the story, So what kind of mind do you want to create? And that's the kind of mind you're going to create with your response. Yeah. Yeah.
So if karmic prints are the impact tends to increase.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of us.
Yeah.
A lot of history. But that, does that mean things are heating up? And is there always a balance?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting thought, to think there are a lot of people with a lot more karma. But basically, you know, of course, in the Buddhist worldview, the consciousness is not just limited to a human rebirth. So, you know, we've been, in the Buddhist worldview, we've been swirling around in many different kinds of rebirths, for, including animal rebirths and but clearly we are experiencing the ripening of a lot of karma, and we're making a lot of karma right now, and in the future, in our future rebirths, we will if we're born in this planet, if you have this worldview where you're born in this world system, we'll experience a lot of ripening of actions created now. I don't know if it's any hotter than it usually is. I think it's always pretty hot. Okay. Time for tea. So, yeah. But it's going to be a very quick answer, but go ahead.
It's about dreams.
You know, please, dreams?
Dreams.
Yeah.
You know, when you have a dream.
Like, yeah. There's no karma created in dreams, unless you wake up and then you run with unless you elaborate upon it. Yeah, because there has to be an intention. There has to be intention. You are only responsible for what you actually are responsible for. If there is an intention, there isn't karma.
Well, I guess that's what I'm...
The ignorance argument, just even as I say that, we want to be careful, because then it's like, oh, if I didn't know, I was passively participating in the oppression of these particular people and benefiting so much from their oppression all of my lifetime, but I didn't know, so therefore I don't have any karma. Well, there's a kind of, you know, there's a kind of ignorance that doesn't want to see that, of course, there's plenty of that. The ignorance can be the negative mental state, the akusala mental state that's powerful there.
It might be.
But in dreams, we really don't have any. There's no intention. That's just the firing of neurons. We're just cleaning up brain cells. And what's that?
Dreams are anxiety dump.
Yeah, that's right. We're just cleaning up brain cells. I mean, we could go on and on about dreams. And the Tibetans sometimes like to go on about dreams and auspicious dreams. But it's all about... You know, you can make a little story about it, and then there becomes some karma. The story, a story that you can make up a story about something that's either kusala or akusala. Your story can have a lot of wisdom in it, and lead you towards something that's true and full of wisdom. Or your story can be akusala. So our stories, they're useful, and a story can be kusala. Yeah, okay, now we really had better stop. Okay, let's just spend 1 second dedicating. So let's think, may our efforts today, our really beautiful efforts to practice today, may they ripen in wisdom and compassion. And may all of those beings with whom we have a karmic connection that we come in contact with, may they benefit from our wisdom and compassion, and may that benefit radiate out in a widening circle, touching each and every being now and in the future.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.